I've had a lot of coffee, and this one stands out. It's called Larry's Coffee. It has this really cute vibe to it, first of all. I've been drinking it in the mornings, and it's noticeably smoother. My favorite blend is Bean Martin. It just tasted so good. I immediately went and got a second cup of coffee. I just love the rich, dark flavor. It's got a little cartoon character on the bag, and he is drinking coffee, and he also has a martini because it's probably an espresso martini because, you know, he's Bean Martin. They have light, medium, dark roast, espresso, decaf. Larry's Coffee is independent, family-owned and operated, roasted in Raleigh, North Carolina for over 30 years. You can try this wonderful coffee and support the BGS Podcast Network at larryscoffee.com/BGS. Listeners of the BGS Podcast Network get a free gift with purchase when they purchase through that show link. And again, that's larryscoffee.com/BGS.
Hello. My name is Olivia Harding, and I am the host of Folk Files, a podcast that explores the tangled history of folk songs. Every month, I choose a topic to dive into for about 20 to 30 minutes. The subject of each episode could be a song. In the case of Shady Grove, a lot of people believe that it is a later version of the English folk song Matty Groves, but it's not that simple. A general topic. The main theme that I saw while researching folk songs about birds from all over the world is that many of them include nonsense syllables meant to represent the bird songs. Or a question that I want to answer. There has never been any real question that Black people were central to the development of this musical style. So why do we still picture white men hauling on the rope when we think of sea shanties? Press play and join me on a journey through the origins of murder ballads, sea shanties, rebel songs, and other music that has withstood the test of time. Folk Files is so pleased to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find us at thebluegrasssituation.com or where you listen.
Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation. Hello, it's me, Cindy House, and I host this podcast. Oh, we're having a heat wave. We're in the heat dome. I'm sure we're out of the heat dome by the time this, well, hopefully by the time this episode comes out. But right now I am in my house in Maine, where it was like 93 degrees today, which is unusual. And also, I just moved into this house, so none of my stuff is set up, so I have a wool blanket over my head to make it sound good, and I can hear the sweat dripping down my back. So let's get into it. You can keep in touch with Basic Folk in a couple different ways. You can subscribe to our newsletter, go to basicfolk.com, or you can find a link in the show notes. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. Or you can become a contributing listener and make a donation to the podcast and help us cover our production expenses. It's very easy to do at basicfolk.com/donate. And we thank you. All right, today is a really special episode. I'm very proud of this one. It features Lizzie Noe and Kamaya Diggs. We are talking about the new compilation Outlaw's Almanac, which features Lizzie, Kaya Cater, Nathan Evans Fox, Olivia Ellen Lloyd, Trey Wellington, AJ Haynes. They are featured on the new compilation Outlaw's Almanac, which is a response to the 250th anniversary of the United States of America, led by executive producer and Basic Folk co-host Lizzie Noe. The project features a diverse range of songwriters and storytellers working in broadly defined folk, Americana, and roots traditions. Lizzie envisioned the compilation as an opportunity to be in conversation with the American Project, taking an oft-overlooked perspectives. Their curation centers Black, Brown, Indigenous, queer, rural, and women's voices with traditional and contemporary music melding in a manner that brings to mind America's promise of being a melting pot. Lizzie and Kamaya join Basic Folk for a candid and vulnerable conversation about the project and its inspirations. We talked about how they each relate to outlaws and the difference between them and those tasked with protection within the law. We also talk about the significance of the album art by Mia Kristen, a folk art-inspired painting of a woman with a guitar riding a donkey surrounded by corn and flowers. I get into the details of some of the bungled celebrations of America's major birthdays, namely the 100th and 200th, and why those celebrations continually leave out marginalized and overlooked voices. We talk about how there are Black people in the future and why this is actually a radical idea in 2026. And we end it with a lighthearted lightning round called Is This Outlaw? Thanks to Lizzie and Kimaya for being so open and honest in this intense and special conversation. We'll listen to clips from Outlaw's Almanac throughout the interview with Lizzie and Kimaya. So let's get into it. It's Lizzie No and Kimaya Diggs on Basic Folk. I am so pleased to welcome Kimaya Diggs and Lizzie No to the podcast to talk about Outlaw's Almanac.
Yay!
Feels like this conversation is going to be illegal.
We're gonna get canceled, baby.
But in a good way.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the only way.
All my heroes were canceled.
And some of my enemies as well.
So true.
Right.
Equal opportunity cancellation.
Right. If you haven't been canceled, what are you doing?
That's true.
It's true.
Shall we get into it?
Let's do it.
All right. So the project Outlaw's Almanac, you call it a new public works project. And the album is in response to the 250th anniversary of the United States of America. And it's meant to be used as a tool for when the rebellion begins. How do each of you relate to Outlaws and how has that relationship evolved?
Are we ready to talk about the Sons of Anarchy on Basic Folk?
Yeah, always.
Are we ready to have that conversation? Sorry, it's just the first thing that my mind goes to because when I was 23, I moved to Washington, D.C. after a bad breakup, and I spent the summer binge watching Sons of Anarchy and writing some of the first songs I would ever release, one of which was called Outlaws. And it's sort of about the bro trope of like, babe, I gotta go fight this battle. Meanwhile, his partner is like raising a child that they share. They co-own property. It's like, what do you mean you're gonna go battle in the streets? Anyway, that's how I felt about, I mean, I love the show Sons of Anarchy.
I feel that way when my wife goes to work.
How dare she?
But in a sense.
I'm just kidding.
I was just so pissed at male pattern, ego-driven, outlaw, cultural product. I was immersed in it and I was annoyed with it. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time I read about Outlaws. And that song like started my career as Lizzie No, because with it, I won a guitar from American Songwriter. And here we are today. And I'm happy to be readdressing Outlaws in like a more politically aware sense than I had at that time. Mm-hmm. Having spent now a decade working in folk and country music and getting to know some outlaw country singers and some, you know, assorted outlaws in real life. It's a fun topic to address.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think when I think about outlaws, I think about actually the Sons of Anarchy thing really resonated with me because I do think about, you know, there's this archetypal lone figure who needs nothing, is not part of society, is so outside. But in the reality of my life, outlawism has been very much about building with other people. So like my grandparents on my mother's side had an interracial marriage that was illegal when they got married. And then my parents also were in an interracial marriage that was not legal at the time when they were born. And so there's this idea to me about being an outlaw is about creating something that is outside of what is acceptable or outside of what people can typically imagine in our collective imagination and dreaming and building, as opposed to the outlaw image of like a lone figure that rejects community, rejects building things. Because that figure is very much about breaking things. Mm-hmm. And to me, being an outlaw is about building things that somebody never imagined.
Mm.
It's so true. And like, whenever we hear the word outlaw in country music, it is that more individualistic ride off into the sunset, do whatever, like loyal to no one cowboy vibe. But when I think of outlaws, I actually know most of them are people who are really good at being in relationship because they have to be, because if the law doesn't protect you, your people have to protect you.
Mm, absolutely.
And so when I think about outlaws that I like have met in person, it's people who are providing abortions in states where that is now illegal and, mm-hmm. you know, criminally punishable. People who are immigrants that a border decided were not like citizens, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wanted to talk about the word protectors or protection. It's so interesting to hear you guys talk about if you're not protected by the law. And you talk about how outlaw history is never canonized, but outlaws are the stewards and protectors of our own collective humanity. If you could talk a little bit about like why you think those outside the law are the ones that have been repeatedly been the protectors over the course of human history, and like what's the difference between them and those tasked with protection within the law?
Hmm. I have a quick answer, but I think Kimaya has a deeper answer because she wrote that. But to start, Dr. Joy James has this book, In Pursuit of Revolutionary Love, which I read on Kayamo last year, actually. Thank God for Kayamo and Time to Read. And in this series of essays and interviews, she describes and kind of like fills in the character of this figure that she calls the captive maternal, which is a Black femme caretaker role, like not thinking about identity as in who am I, but more identity of like, what do I do? Like being maternal as one of the people that takes care of the revolutionaries throughout time, and your positioning within the empire as the one most outside the law makes you uniquely capable of providing the type of support that the state could never think to provide. Mm. And one of the roles of the captive maternal is to hold the state accountable for when our children are killed, and like hold the society accountable to our humanity as a collective. So I don't know what the why is, but that's an idea that I'm like, I think we're working out on this record and kind of in all of our work as Black women artists. I don't know if you've felt that, Kimaya.
I absolutely have. I approached this when I was writing the liner notes for the record. One thing that kept coming up to me was this linguistic notion of what you can't name, you can't imagine. And that appears in all sorts of different cultures. For example, like a lot of languages didn't have a word for blue for a long time, or purple for a long time, and referred to different shades of blue as either, you know, green or other things like that, or cultures that use one, two, and many instead of another wider numerical system. It actually changes the way that you think about time. It changes the way that you think about and perceive your reality. And so I think the big difference between people who are outside of the protective structures are forced to develop, almost without language, another framework with which to envision a different future. Because it's almost like if you imagine our government, the police forces, as one language, that's a language that does not know how to speak to a Black mother. It's a language that does not know how to speak to a disabled person or a queer person or somebody else living on the margins. And so people in these communities are forced to develop these sort of extra linguistic ways of thinking and imagining and envisioning. And I think you see that in the creativity of Care Coalition, in the creativity of marginalized activism. And so to me, again, it brings me back to that image of outlaws as being a village and, you know, a hearth.
Hmm. The cover art of this album is by Mia Kirsten. And for those who haven't seen it, can you describe what it looks like and also its significance?
I love this painting quilt piece of art so much. Mia is so true as an artist. Like, I love the way that she sees the world, and I've loved album covers she's done in the past. So I was really happy that she hand painted our album cover. That part was important when it came to this project. Everything had to be made by hand in some regard. The conversations that Mia and I had to do with like reconstruction and starting over, because in a sense, a revolution is a starting over as much as it is like the destruction of one thing. Like it 1776, if we're, you know, assigned to look at that date, okay, a revolution that kind of broke an old thing and made a some sort of new thing. I wanted to imagine what it would be like to have that opportunity now to like start a society from who's here now. Like if we had a really honest reckoning with who are the people who live in this land, regardless of how they got here, we should be starting over and planting and redoing things in a more harmonious way. So this is a woman leading the people into the new world.
She's not riding side saddle, I've noticed, and she's on a donkey.
She's on a donkey. She's got her blue donkey.
Mm. I love it.
There had to be corn. There had to be corn in this image. For so many reasons, I was like, Mia, there's got to be corn.
Got to be corn, yeah.
Or something growing, you know?
Keep my dog away from that.
I love that there's corn in it because it also makes me think of like when we hear the sort of pilgrim story and the Thanksgiving story, there's this like legendary status put on the corn, like the native people, they brought corn and it was a sign that they were welcome. And then from there, the people who felt welcome decided to take over the entire damn piece of land. And like the corn has this sort of mythical element to it that I think is almost like the seed of the American legend as it kind of exists.
Wow.
Yes. And what's funny is that like the first thing that I think of when I see this particular corn is how like that we've haven't tasted sugar in generations. Everything is like corn syrup based now. And so that sort of monocrop culture is a huge part of our American culture as well.
Right. Yeah. Everybody gets a huge corn cob on July 4th this year. It's going to be great.
Okay, but don't get it twisted. I'm from New Jersey. I love corn on the cob.
Me too.
No shade to corn. Lots of shade to corporations.
On my birthday this year, my brother-in-law, who knows I love popcorn, gave me a 50-pound bag of popcorn kernels.
Wow, that's going to last a lifetime.
Yes.
I climb just above the high line, looking for a skyline, some familiar ground. All I can see are purple mountains for miles around. And Bear Creek stretches out before me, spilling out my story before I can begin. How can I show you where I'm going if you don't know where I've been? How long will I love my enemies? Until I'm right back where I started, crying I can't breathe.
Lizzie, you are credited as executive producer on this project. And because we're besties, I know some things. There were many ups and downs process, not to get too deep into it, but can you comment on what this project has done to your confidence and how it might impact your next recording? And then maybe Kamaya, can you comment on Lizzie as an executive producer?
This project required me to lean on my friends and comrades in a way I've never had to do. Professionally before, we all depended on one another in every regard. Every single aspect of this album was a collaboration, from the way the recordings were made to the way the album art came about to the way in which the business side had to like make sense as well. Like there's so much trust involved, and I feel proud that I took everybody's trust very, very seriously from the beginning, because I wanted everyone to feel seen and completely heard and not exploited in any way, because we all have experiences in the music industry where the thing that makes you special and unique and different is what gets you in the room. And then it's also the thing that's either not welcome or misrepresented or misunderstood or outright, you know, denigrated behind the scenes. We all, unfortunately, many of us that are workers in this industry, we've experienced that. So I sort of just had a hard line from the very beginning. This process has to reflect the values that we're talking about in the liner notes. If we're talking about reconstruction and repaying Black people and rematriating land, that's what it has to look like in the process. We have to have a lot of women leading, people of color especially. People need to have the freedom to say exactly what they want. Like, we have to live these truths, you know, as if they are self-evident in the recording booth.
Mm.
So in that sense, it was like the most difficult and also the most empowering recording I've ever made. And especially having the executive producer role, doing so much of the A&R, it felt like I was more thick as thieves with my comrades than I've ever been before.
I would say when I first heard about this project, I didn't know yet that I would be contributing a song to it. And even then, I was just absolutely elated to know that it was in Lizzie's hands. I think that a lot of people, especially working musicians, or, you know, any working person needs to survive and needs to just, you know, make ends meet and get through things. And it's very easy in this industry in particular to constantly focus on what is in it for you, because we all need to make connections with people. We all need to network in these ways. We're all looking for opportunities. Some opportunities truly are limited, and it can feel sort of like grabby sometimes. And Lizzie is someone who, throughout the years, anywhere I go, everybody knows her, for one. And everybody is like, I absolutely love them. They're so smart. They told me about this person and now we're friends. And it's like, Lizzie is clearly a person who is a bridge builder. And that's an incredibly rare thing. I think that's like an intrinsic quality that people either have or they don't. And so as soon as I knew that this project was happening, I knew that the personnel would be incredibly intentionally chosen, chosen with love, chosen with care, chosen to tell a very intentional story. And it feels like a huge, huge, huge honor to be a part of it and to help tell that story. And I just feel like Lizzie is one of the visionaries of our time. And
yes,
anyone who gets to work with them is incredibly fortunate.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Now do me. Just kidding. It's so awesome. So beautiful.
Oh my gosh. Please redact my tears from the pod, or don't.
Never. I never would do that. Gosh. Yeah. It's.
Do you see what I mean? These people are locked in. I have the coolest friends in the world.
Yeah. You said you created a space of sacred permission, which, Kimaya, beautiful writing.
Thank you.
How is that space created and what makes it sacred?
I need to talk about Nick Rapley's house. My longtime drummer and co-producer and friend, Nick, lives in Indiana, which is great for many reasons. First, he is living in the house that his grandmother lived in all her life. She left behind a lot of her, like pretty much all of her original decor, his mom's Barbies. Like, there's, it's a matriarchal, passed down, beautiful home. Indiana is also really great if you want to pull together American artists from several corners to fly in for one of two recording days. And if your theme is rural progress, you should make the record out in the country. So these were like the sort of divine things that came together in terms of where we recorded the album. And to walk into Nick's house, oh, it is one of my favorite things. He's one of my oldest friends. And knowing that these are the same steps his grandmother and grandfather walked down, that like generations of people of a family have been living in that house, once you get down to the basement, like, I think we all who are close with our grandmothers know what it feels like to have her, like, give you that look of, like, it's time to be real. Like, grandma wants you to tell the truth and do your best and be your bravest self. That was the energy that I think both Nick and I and all of the artists brought to that, to the sessions. We were talking about grandmas quite a lot.
Real grandma energy.
Yeah. If you want to talk about the revolution, you need to start with your grandmother.
Wow. Yes. So here's where I want to talk about past centennial celebrations in this country. So, like, Jill Lepore wrote this, like, hilarious article in The New Yorker. It came out in March about the 1976 celebration. And I feel like, and also, like, there's, I mean, these are all, like, a lot of articles I've read in The New Yorker about this are just like, what is happening, you know, and I, you know. It's kind of sounds like no one is prepared. It's like very unorganized and like very tone deaf. And like all of the past celebrations have also been like kind of very, very, very tone deaf. So like, okay, in the centennial celebration was in 1876. Do you guys know any of these facts?
I don't.
Okay.
I don't think so. I'm about to find out.
Okay. So it was a massive event that took place in Philadelphia. It kind of like highlighted America's technological and industrial progress, however, like completely ignored the severe social injustices of this country, like especially like broken treaties with the indigenous people. The Battle of Little Bighorn was like a week before this happened. This celebration also promoted cultural stereotypes, which is so gross, largely excluded African-Americans and Native Americans from the official narrative of like American freedom.
That's literally how they continue to do us today.
Yeah. And
redacted.
So they were like promoting all of these like industrial progresses and technological progresses. However, like laborers and industrial workers were like facing heavy crackdowns and exploitation by private police forces during this era. So like that's 1876.
That's such an American classic.
God, Bad News Bears. Okay, so like
yesterday.
Check this out. This is the other one. I won't get into this one as much just because like we don't have all day, but the bicentennial.
Cindy, I would listen to you tell Roast tales America. Of history all day long.
So the bicentennial 1976 took place in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, which went so well for everything. And hang on to your hats.
Horrifying.
The Watergate scandal.
Oh, God.
And it was very heavily criticized for being shallow and exclusionary, which are like my two biggest nightmares, to be known as shallow and exclusionary. So now we're on this celebration in 2026 is the semi-quincentennial. The 250th. It's very like similar controversies regarding whose history is being told, of course, and how like the milestone is being leveraged. And capitalism has also played a huge part in this. You're talking about in 1976, like it was so commercialized that it was like, oh my God, this feels disgusting. So I don't know. What do you guys think about these celebrations, like continually leaving out marginalized and overlooked voices, like What do you think those organizers are thinking? Like, are they afraid? And like, what are they afraid of?
The way that I feel about America 250, Freedom 250, Liberty 250, whatever they are calling it, is the way that I feel about a couple that spends a massive amount of money on a full-blown wedding to renew their vows when everyone in their lives knows that they are a nightmare. They dislike each other. They don't belong together. Like,
I'm trying they're making not to each laugh. Other.
Like, they're... Like, they shouldn't be together. Okay. However, do you go to the party? However, do you accept the gig as a DJ at that wedding? I am the DJ at that wedding. As a musician in 2026, I don't know what these white people are on about. We are at war with Iran. We paid for and enacted a genocide. And a continuing ongoing genocide in Palestine to this day. Our Black population is largely as incarcerated as we were enslaved.
Oh, yeah.
What are we celebrating? Who has freedom meaningfully in this country? Don't even let me get to how corporations have stolen all of our time, our interests, our intimate relationships. Mm-hmm. Okay. I don't see a lot to celebrate on the nation state scale. However, if a party is to be thrown, if there are to be songs sung, it's my job to do some of the song singing.
Mm-hmm.
So some of these tracks on Outlaw's Almanac, to be frank, are diss tracks. The one I love in the Freedom Road is about how we should never forgive the founding fathers for owning slaves. That's what that's about. And that's for America's 250th. I am so happy to give this country the beautiful, artistically diverse, radical songbook I believe that we deserve.
I like it when her hair falls in my face. I like the way her collarbones taste. She could
the historical celebrations that you talked about, I'm like, nothing is more American than a big cash grab and a big scam. And I expect to see so much more of that in the coming weeks.
Scam Nation.
Scam Nation, yes. Yeah. But I think that there is no, as Lizzie said, no nation state way to, quote, celebrate the anniversary. I think it is an important one to mark simply in the calendar. I don't feel that there's any sort of programming that would make me feel good about it and make me feel like the story is really being told. But I think it is important to be like, okay, at this point in time, a lot of things changed for a lot of people. A lot of what is terrible about the American experience was written into law at that time. And then also, it's important to take a moment, like so many younger people don't even realize how long the colonies and the American sort of project was in the works before 1776. Like, many generations of people were born and died before the USA was, like, born. People were living here for so, so, so long. There was so much political turmoil back and forth with the UK or with England at the time. And it's important to be like, okay, this is the 250th anniversary of something. And it's important to know what that is. But it's also important to know that a lot of what we are experiencing right now, the American legend began long before that.
Can I talk about 1776 for a second?
Please.
And I could not agree more with everything that Kimaya has to say. I would like to learn everything from you. I feel like I've had enough time now with producing this album to, like, reflect on what exactly are we commemorating. And I don't think most Americans think about, I don't know, maybe some most people think about Paul Revere. But I think the thing that we're really, like, commemorating this year is this, you know, the signing of the Declaration of Independence, which for me is an intellectual act of asserting who has personhood in the land and who is a citizen and who has a right to speak on the conditions under which everybody will live. To write a document describing the freedoms that you and all humans deserve to have and that you're willing to fight for and, like, leave England for while you own human beings and have them in shackles is so wild to me. And that's why I have kind of an eye roll response to this being the big anniversary that's celebrated, because we're not celebrating, like, achievements of human innovation. We're celebrating a document that says we have the right to say who is and is not a person.
Mm. And it could have been almost good. Like, there is some, like, audacity that I want to acknowledge about the the notion of crossing this huge sea and just deciding that you're going to do your own thing, even if it's, you know, at the expense of everybody who already lived there. But I think about, like, how powerful the Declaration of Independence could have been. I'm in Massachusetts, and so I grew up always knowing the story of Mary Freeman, who was an enslaved woman who didn't know how to read, but heard people in her household discussing the Declaration of Independence, and then sued for her own freedom using the Declaration of Independence as a primary document. And I'm like, if that had been sort of, like, the foundation of that moment, that would have led us to a very different place. Instead, the fact that the document could be used to empower everyone was seen as a major threat, and I think then laid the groundwork for a lot of the suppressive and oppressive structures that ensure that the United States is non-functional and non-beneficial for anyone besides white men.
Mm. Lizzie has answered this question before, and it'll be fun to have Kimaya in on it. So, if case anyone forgets or needs to go back and listen to Basic Folks 250th episode, where we break down your Halfsies album, Lizzie, you were talking about on that album and also on this compilation as an opportunity to be in conversation with, fill in the blank, a person, an idea. So this is an opportunity to be in conversation with the American Project from Overlooked Voices. So can you briefly explain what it's like as an artist to be in conversation? And part two, what did you discover from this conversation that surprised you?
I had a very spooky experience writing my song for this compilation because I did feel a lot of pressure to be in conversation and dialogue with basically everything, the entire history. I have immigrants on one side of my family and civil rights fighters on the other side of my family. And I was like, I want to tell the story. It was interesting. My initial impulse was I want to write a song that conveys to white people how much harm they've caused. And I was like, I can't, that's such a huge scale. And so somebody basically recommended I meditate and ask my ancestors for help, which is really not my vibe, but I tried it because I was running out of time.
I'm desperate.
Exactly. I literally had tried so much other stuff. And I sat in my basement with my guitar and my little phone for voice memos and abruptly entered into conversation, quite literally, with an individual entity who I could not figure out who they were. And I felt that they were far away in time, and so that the intermediary who was connecting directly with me was my mom, and my mom was like relaying a story from the past. I wrote the whole song in 6 minutes. It came out of me faster than I could write it down. And it was a fully formed story that I didn't understand what it was about until much, much later. And so in that way, I entered into quite literal conversation with a being or an entity or an energy or a story. And I'm not a super spiritual person, so I'm like, I don't know, was this a ghost? Was this an ancestor? Was it an epigenetic memory making itself known in my body or what? But it ended up being quite a literal conversation in a way, wow, that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, that's surprising, we'll say.
Yeah. Yes, I've never experienced anything like it. It was very spooky.
Wow.
Chills.
Yeah.
Redact that.
Is this whole interview going to be redacted?
It's going to be a 1 hour long bleep.
Yeah.
Bloop. Bloop, 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 bloop,
bloop, bloop, bloop, bloop. I could have Francie make turkey noises over it.
Happy birthday, Francie.
Happy birthday, Francie.
There's a riot in the street. They said the wolf was at the front door. He was lying at their feet. We felt a change, but ain't a shame how it all turned out. Back then it was a long time coming. It's a little late now. They're gonna stack up the dead till they black out the sun. These white boys with money make the whole world run. Let the wall hit your back, blood hit your tongue. Now you and me, baby, we're the dangerous one.
Lizzie, would you like to share anything about what surprised you in being in conversation on this album?
I asked a lot of the artists that contributed songs, like, sure, they knew it was going to be an America 250 something or other album. So to narrow down the assignment a little bit, I asked people if there was a song that they had written or that was important to their people or told the story of their people in this country. Like, what is your people's story here? And everybody had such a different response to it. I think the thing that surprised me was the cohesive story that this album ended up telling when the artists really were not in consultation with one another about song selection, except for the folks that happened to be in, you know, the same studio session day. Like even people that sent in tracks remotely, like Knevins Fox, AJ Haynes, like we all had this sense of coming to an awareness of our surroundings here and now, making sure that the songs were like really in real time and felt immediate, and were also so liberatory. I feel like from the beginning of the album to the end, we accomplished what I was sort of starting to hope to accomplish with Halfsies, which is step by step, give instructions to get free. Like if you start with the longing to hear somebody pray, it means you haven't even really gotten in touch with yourself yet, or you're very lonely and far away from home. So you need to, like, at least, you know, let the divine know, I want to hear somebody sing. Then you have to tell your story. You know, Olivia Ellen Lloyd's In the Valley is a song about displacement and being a migrant worker and looking up at the stars and wondering if anything's ever going to change for you. And then Casey Anderson and Eric Amble have a true outlaw country song about rioting. Because when you come to this awareness of the ways in which things are not as they should be, your natural and correct response is to let it burn, let it burn, let the motherfucker burn. It's election day. On to take this hammer. Like, I don't want this job. I don't want this burden of having to speak for Black people. I don't want this burden of history. I don't want to be like, I didn't choose to be here. Take this hammer. Tell them I'm gone. You know, you have to run and get your freedom as our ancestors did. Then Kapali Long comes in with One Day, and it's like the contemporary tale of like when you're depending on yourself and your community for survival instead of like inherited wealth, things feel really hand to mouth. And like that reality of like, let's work together, things are going to get better. Like it feels like you're just not even going to make it through another day. That's the truth for so many American workers. You know, the kind of balm and antidote to that is A.J. Haynes' Slowly. Like when it all starts to feel too overwhelming, look beyond yonder pines, breathing slowly, slowly.
Gosh, that song is so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's a showstopper.
Side A or whatever. I feel like this entire album is different American artists' versions of what it takes to get free and to like live as ourselves in this society.
You also just answered my question about the sequence of this album, because it did seem very intentional. And so that is the narrative of the song order. But there's also this Frederick Douglass quote in the liner notes that says, "I therefore leave off where I begin with hope." So that got me thinking that that has to do, that's that you're including that in the liner notes. That's got to be in relation to the sequence of the of this album.
Yeah, when I wrote the liner notes, I'm not sure if I'd known the final sequence at the time. And then when I listened back again to the final sequence, I realized that to be an outlaw is to be courageous. And courageousness, meaning doing what you need to do in the face of fear. And I think so often, especially when we discuss revolution, there are these hypotheticals, especially around like election times, like, should we vote? No, we need to just burn it down. Or yes, let's vote. Let's do what we can in the system. Like there's this tension and there's a lot of fear behind the notion of, or associated with the notion of burning things down and starting over. And what I wanted to land on with the liner notes is that it's not just about the burning. And I think about it like a forest fire in the Great West. It clears the land for what needs to come. And we might not be able to imagine what it is, especially if you don't live in a marginalized part of our society. It's almost impossible to imagine what comes next, because it's your habitat that's being burned down. But if you are someone living on the margins of society, imagining what comes next is easy. Imagining what comes next is second nature and is instinct and is what allows us to survive. And so I wanted to just end on that note. Like, it's not destruction for destruction's sake. It's land clearing for growth's sake.
Beautiful.
They're getting beloved back together for one more show in Kernersville. June, you died, and June, you came back in the same year. Me and Mac moved on from his 3-inch left knee song. These days we kick around Nashville with his old songs on. Well, everything will go, some things come back again. The best of things are sweeter with a little bitterness. Me, I'm out in Nashville thinking I might call this home. Some things are coming back again, and the rest of them are gone.
It kind of folds in really well to this next topic. Lizzie, you say there's this narrative that Black and brown voices are contained to the past. I wanted to make us contemporary to show that we exist now, that our roots are alive. Which, Lizzie, I texted you about this before our conversation today, brought to mind the There Are Black People in the Future public art project by the artist Alicia B. Wormsley, where she placed that phrase, "There are Black people in the future," on a billboard in Pittsburgh's East Liberty, which is experiencing some crazy gentrification, where there's poverty on one side of the street and a Warby Parker on the other side of the street.
Mm-hmm.
That phrase has since made its way onto billboards in several other cities around the United States and the world. There are Black people in the future. What do you feel when you hear that phrase? And why do you think that statement is so radical?
I'm getting so sad. Because I feel like when this presidential administration came in, the first issue that they tackled was how can we erase Black women from the history books, from the workplace, from positions of power everywhere. And we saw it on every level in this country, like media censorship, professors losing their jobs, Black women of every profession being pushed out of the workplace. There is a concerted attempt by our government to get rid of or further exploit certain people based on their identities. And that's why it was so powerful to see Star Trek as a kid. Because there's, you know, sorry, I'm jumping in time. It's just like this American capitalist machine is not interested in Black people as human beings. It's useful or gone for us. And that's why we have to like remind one another that we are still human beings and that more than anything, we can like grow into the next generation and like we have what it takes to survive and that the future includes us. Because there's just times when it feels like to be in America is to be told that the future does not contain people that look like you. The future that Elon Musk is building does not contain free, autonomous, gay Black women. So thank God we've been making our own thing in every like space that we inhabit. Like Black women are always creating some space where we and others who are loving belong. That's often our job in this world, whether we like it or not, whether we want to or not. And that's what it takes to survive apocalyptic conditions. So, on Octavia Butler, There Are Black People in the Future.
Dark, white dog below, my heart is broken by what has left me. I've been forsaken, branded, but what's forsaken me has left me free. Alone, I am never alone. To feel alone is to act like the flesh of a bone. This land's buried in bones. The promise in life turns to promise to do that to me. Be brave, dance a riddle, braided the lines into my sister's hair. Each day thread the needle, leave out some sugar for ghosts who aren't there. Oh, and I am never alone. I promise myself that this land could be all that I need. Don't let my girls deceive. The promise of life is a promise that I cannot.
Now it's time to play a lighthearted game called Is This Outlaw?
Yes.
The game is this. I'm going to cite an event, an object, or a person. It's a yes or no question, yes or no answer. I'll count to three. So you have 3 seconds to think about, is this outlaw? Are you guys ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Is this outlaw? The Boston Tea Party. 3, 2, 1.
Yes.
No.
I'm saying this is a Massachusetts girl.
Okay, I love this game. I almost said yes.
Is this outlaw? The dress from the internet that people didn't know the color of. 3, 2, 1.
No.
Yes. Oh my God.
Is this outlaw? Jesse Wells. 3, 2, 1.
Redacted.
I decline.
A consensus.
A consensus.
Okay.
We agree to not say
okay.
Anything.
This one
You're
I'm asked.
You're trying to get me canceled again.
This one I'm asking for a friend, and the friend is me. Is this outlaw pretending to be your wife when you call your insurance company? 3, 2, 1.
Yes.
No.
This is great. You guys aren't agreeing on anything.
I know.
And maybe the real outlaw shit was the stuff we didn't agree on along the way.
Oh. All right. I just have 25 more. Is this outlaw? The Grammys. 3, 2, 1.
Don't you dare include this in the recording. I will be drawn and quartered, and that will not be very outlaw. But no, actually, canonically, the Grammys are the law.
Okay. Okay. Two more. Is this outlaw stealing from the post office? 3, 2, 1.
No. Yes, but I wouldn't espouse that type of outlaw behavior.
Interesting. Outlaws contain
okay,
multitudes.
Okay, wait. I would have changed. Yeah. I agree.
That's not the type of outlaw I hang around, but I do know that they're
all
out
right,
there, maybe.
We've got 2 out of 2 agrees on this.
I'm like, okay. Steal from the government, but not the post office.
Right, because everyone loves
no,
the
those
post
people
office.
Work hard. Those people work really hard to keep us connected. And there is also a far-right attack on the post office. So, yeah, shout out to the post office, actually.
All right, this is the last one. Is this outlaw feeling yourself? 3, 2, 1.
It depends who you are.
Yes. Oh, wait, you're so true. I'm like, yeah, thinking, yes. Certain people, if they're feeling themselves, it's offensive and I don't want to see it. And everyone else, I'm down. I'm
yeah,
talking about.
Honestly, like, it's a narrow list. Like 99.999% of people, we deserve to feel ourselves.
Yes.
Lindsey Graham, if you're feeling yourself right now, go to hell.
Exactly.
What a wonderful place to end this interview, Kimaya Diggs. Lizzie, no. It's just, I'm so proud of you guys, and I don't really know what else to say. It just seems as though, like, this compilation seems like the actual American dream. Congratulations for creating this, and thank you for the great conversation.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you for your kind attention, as always, Cindy.
Yeah.
And thank you for making it, Lizzie. MVP of the world.
Ah, yeah, 100%.
Thank you, Kimaya, for telling the stories. My God.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Our music is composed by Dietrich Strauss. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there. You can also find us by searching for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app, FolkAlley.com, or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can also find us at BasicFolk.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, send it to your racist uncle and tell him to be quiet. Okay, thanks for listening all the way to the end. Talk to you next time. Bye.